Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is G. Pagar, and I'm your MC for today. It is my great pleasure to welcome you all to this wonderful event, the ISO International Student Organization fundraising for Ebola. Every academic year, the International Students Organization at EMU takes upon itself to support a social cause. Over the past few years, we've raised awareness about modern-day slavery in Haiti and conflict minerals in the Congo. This year, we've decided to undertake an ambitious initiative, an initiative we hope will go far in helping kids who've had their family structures disrupted by the Ebola virus. We thank you all for joining us here today for this event. We are grateful to have in our presence an alumni of EMU, Ms. Lema Bowie. I know her as Auntie Lema. And this is Winifred Gray Johnson. She's the one who conceived the idea for this program. So we are thankful to have you all here. Welcome. At this time, we're going to have the opening prayer by the Provost, Dr. Fredness.
Thank you, and thank you all for coming. I'm happy to welcome everyone on behalf of the university, and a special thank you to our international student organization and their leaders for all the work it took to put this event together. Please join me now in a prayer of invocation as we open ourselves to God's presence with us this evening. Loving God, we come to you tonight in gratitude for your loving presence with all the people of the earth. We are grateful for the wealth and health that we enjoy here in this place simply by the accident of our birth and our life circumstances. Give us generous spirits and the wisdom we need to share our prosperity in life-giving ways. We are grateful here on this campus, in this particular spot on the globe, that we are surrounded by beauty, by peace, and by a caring community. Help us to be more deeply mindful of the many places on earth where these gifts are not so abundant. We are grateful in particular this evening for Lema Bowie's presence with us and for her life and work in places that yearn for health and peace. Prepare our minds, open our ears, soften our hearts, empower our hands and feet so that we may follow her example and the example of all your prophets who show us how to multiply the places around our shared planet where your love, your grace, and your justice reign over our lives together as fellow human beings. We ask all this, trusting in your loving presence. Amen.
At this time, we're going to have a song by Alicia Igazar. And after that, we'll hear from Auntie Lema. We're going to have the introduction of Auntie Lema by Ms. Jen Jenner.
And the moon Good evening. It's really my very great pleasure tonight to introduce Lema Bowie as our speaker tonight. I think many of you here know the details of her CV and history. I don't want to go over that. She graduated from here. I'll go over it very shortly. She was a social worker in Liberia. She then came and graduated from EMU in 2007, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011 for work that she had done starting in 2003 with the Women's Mass Action Campaign, which helped to end the war in Liberia. But one thing that I have learned from knowing Lema for a long time before she won the prize and now after that is that I think as a person gains fame, gains a position, their person kind of gets lost. And so I thought tonight as I introduced Lema, I would just share a few stories that for me are the real person behind the Nobel Peace Prize winner. I first met Lema in 2002 when I was representing EMU at a meeting of a large NGO in Ghana in West Africa. And Lema was also there at that same meeting. At that point, she was a social worker working with young child soldiers in a program that was trying to rehabilitate and reintegrate these child soldiers. And Lema and I had dinner together one night during that meeting. And I remember her talking for a very long time about the work she was doing. And I came away thinking about the emotions that she expressed during that time. And I've thought about it an awful lot since through the years. Lema was really frustrated and I think sometimes despairing of the work she was doing. It was very difficult work. At times it could be personally dangerous. These were kids that had been really traumatized by what had happened to them and had done some really tough things. She was also angry, really angry at the war, at the situation that had caused those young boys to be in that situation, and at the kind of the trap that I think she felt she and other Liberians were in. And then she was compassionate. She kept expressing so much care and love for these boys and the people that, the boys that she was working with, and talking about the potential they had and how she just wanted to draw this out. And I remember thinking that combination of frustration, of anger, and of compassion and love, that's pretty powerful. And so then it was not too long afterwards that Lema and a group of women started working on a larger scale that ended in that mass campaign to end the war in Liberia. And my guess is, though I wasn't around you very much at that time, Lema, my guess is that you had those same feelings of compassion, anger, and frustration and despair during that whole time as you brought to that work you had earlier. Then just one other short story. About 2 years ago, I was in Liberia again for work with EMU just before Christmas. It was around the 15th, something like that in December. And at that point, since she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, Lema has devoted a lot of time to working with the girl child on young women in Liberia and in West Africa, and particularly in funding scholarships for them, both to secondary schools and to universities. And at that point, I was doing work in her office at that point, and there was one young girl that they had brought in from a very rural area to go to secondary school. And I remember all the women men and women in the office talking about how bright this young girl was, what a bright future she had, and what a impoverished background she had come from, an impoverished village where girls really didn't receive education. But now it was Christmas holiday, and it was time for the young girl to go back and connect with her family and community again. But because of weather, rains, and other things, the roads were impassable, and they couldn't figure out how to get her back. And so Lema and the other women and men in the office huddled together for a couple hours trying to figure out, what do they do? Do they just keep the young girl in Monrovia for the holiday and not let her reconnect to the family, or do they go so far as to try to figure out how to get a helicopter to get her back? I left before they figured out what they were doing, so I don't really know if that girl got back to her family for Christmas or not. But once again, I was really impressed with how Lema exhibited her concern for that one young girl. And I think, for me, that's important to keep in mind as we hear her speak tonight, that yes, Lema is the Nobel Prize winner. She walks with kings and once met Mick Jagger and didn't know who he was, which I just love. So she walks with kings and Mick Jagger, but she also cares deeply about that one young girl and many other young girls and young boys from Liberia, from West Africa, and from the world. And so Lema, welcome.
I think one of the things that Jen, the compassion, the anger, every other feeling, Jen, to just update you, has morphed into a bit of insanity. I think that's where I am now, a little bit of crazy. I'm truly honored to be here back at EMU. I wish this would have been a happier, gathering. Ebola is something that is never a happy thing. But I thought to spend a few minutes whilst talking about Ebola, letting us come back to for many of us who find ourselves in the field of social justice, and for those of us who care about humanity, even if we don't call ourselves activists, I want us to think about this question even as we leave from here. Why should we care? Why should any of us care about Ebola? Why should we care about Syria and Somalia and Iraq and Afghanistan? Why should we care about Libya? Why should we care about orphans and widows? Why should we just care about humanity? I want us to think about this, because as I travel from one place to the other, sometimes you get these very challenging questions about, why should I care about Africa? So let's think about it. But as we even think through the Ebola virus, I want to just take us back to the history of this virus, and I'm sure people have read. The first sighting of the virus was 1976, and it was in Sudan, and they call it the Sudan Ebola virus. And in 1976, this is between June to November, you had 284 cases and 151 deaths. In Zaire, in the same 1976, you had 318 cases and 280 deaths. And then it went away. In 1995, it came back again. And this time, it was in the DR Congo. 315 cases, 254 deaths. 2000 in Uganda, 425 cases, 224 deaths. 2003 in Congo Brazzaville, 143 cases, 128 deaths. In 2007, it came back in DRC, 264 cases, 187 deaths. And then in the same 2007 was found in Uganda, 149 cases, 37 deaths. In 2012, it came back in Uganda, 7 cases, 4 deaths. A few weeks later, it came back, 24 cases, 17 deaths. And then 2014. So this is not a strange virus to the world. This is something that everyone knows. Once it attacks, the death rate is between 25 to 90%. So when it hit Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, you would think that there were already mechanisms in place to tackle these issues, because these were three countries who, if you look at the World Index of healthcare structures or infrastructures, is technically non-existent. In some of these countries, Sierra Leone, for example, have one doctor to every, 1,000 people or more. Liberia has 51 doctors. That's it for 3.4 million people. So you want to ask yourself, so why were they not prepared to deal with this particular issue? The virus came and wreaked havoc on our communities. Today, we have children who would never have parents again because all of their parents died as a result of the virus. In mid-November, someone wrote me from Sierra Leone, and there was a village there where they had just tracked 500 orphans. And the question you want to ask yourself, how will these children survive, especially given that they find themselves in post-conflict countries? In Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, though we had a whole lot of media attention, but the response to the virus was so slow that it took a lot away from communities than it would ever give back to them, maybe for the next 20 years. We had situations in these countries where, as a result of the Ebola virus, the maternal mortality rate started going up because pregnant women who could not access health care were again dying at childbirth. The infant mortality rate that these countries had been fighting to bring down was again going up because babies were being sacrificed even as their mothers were saved in childbirth. So you had all of these situations in these different countries happening. In Liberia specifically, civil society again rose to the occasion. And when I was on NPR a few months back, and we were talking about the Ebola virus, and the journalist kind of hinted that people in these countries were sitting and waiting for the West again to save us. And I said to him, no, I'll give you a typical example. I'll give you several examples. There was a doctor in Monrovia called Dr. Jerry Brown, and he has become one of the famous faces of Ebola in Liberia. Time magazine recognized him as one of those hero doctors. Dr. Brown ran a clinic, and the clinic he ran was ERWA 1 or 2. And next to Dr. Brown, in the same compound, was Doctor Without Borders. They ran ERWA 3. And if you went to Dr. Brown's clinic, the local people would say you were in hell, because he lacked electricity, whilst the clinic in the same compound had electricity and all of the sophisticated equipment. Dr. Brown recorded more survival rates in his side of the clinic than the sophisticated clinics. But beyond that, he was one of those doctors who was not just treating Ebola, but was helping deliver babies when everyone else was shying away from it. My husband and I would have lost his youngest sister had it not been for his commitment to life, because she went in needing cesarean. The nurses were afraid to touch her, and he put his foot down that they would give that cesarean because he didn't think she had the virus. So this is one hero doctor that you would never hear about on CNN, or BBC, or Al Jazeera, or the Euro News. But this is just an example of a local person who stood up and decided, I will stand by. By October, November, when my office called Dr. Brown, he had run out of water completely. He was down to his last bit of energy drink. his last bit of water and his last bit of sheets, because they didn't have the disposable sheets.
So they called and we could not get them brand new sheets. So the office said they were going to get used sheets from the used clothes market. And I was frantic that this is not hygienic. And so if you all have to do it, you can make the donations this weekend, because I want you all to wash it, bleach it, press it, and make it presentable. And he was like, people, just send me what you have, because I'm down to my last sheet. In local communities, women's groups and organizations, again, were mobilizing, stepping up the educational campaign, and really going out to educate people. Some of the similarities between what we saw during this Ebola virus peak and what we saw during the wartime is that the internationals come, and yes, they come with the resources and they come with a lot of money, but they do not have the local knowledge, context, or means of communicating with the local people. And if you leave out the local people in this fight, you've left out a whole group of your allies in dealing with the crisis. And this is what we saw. So again, it was the local communities, the radio stations, and people who were using local languages and local jargons to talk about cases that have peaked in one area and cases that were going down in another area, or dead bodies that were in this other community. Another example of a hero is a representative, one of the lawmakers in Liberia, had several ambulances, but I think it was one at first, and he put it out there. And that man and his ambulance became the face of picking up sick people from the streets of Monrovia. Today, given that the virus is now only 6 actual cases in Liberia, his ambulance service have crossed the border to Sierra Leone. But you will never read about him on the news or in local papers. I'm saying this to make this point that, yes, we had this virus and we still have it, but again, local people were stepping up. A few months back, coming back to why should we care? My organization, the people in the organization decided I work too hard and they have to cut down some of the things that I do. So they fired me from the foundation. I'm jobless. If anyone is looking for someone to hire, so I'm totally out. I can only sit on the board and they will use me to raise money, but nothing else. So I don't play, and I have an office that is just a monument in there. And then they were like, you have to stop doing this. Because again, there was a lot of pressure and people were concerned that I was going to cave in under the pressure. The day we had the meeting and I solemnly told my team that I'm going to not do this again. The next morning, Jay has a favorite spot in the house that he will sit. I have my favorite spot. And I'm sitting there, pick my laptop, and I'm reading a story about 4 young children, of the many children who have been orphaned by Ebola. So these are the Copper kids. And the story talks about how their parents died, and one of their siblings died, but the 16-year-old sister had a bit of money and decided to sell ice water as a means of taking care of her siblings, 14, 11, and 10. And no one in the community will buy from them. Not only would they not buy from them, everyone who was trying from outside the community to buy from them, don't go there. Their parents had Ebola. So the stigma was just difficult, and these children could not even find food to eat. The only reason they live in the house that they live in was because their parents had paid the rent prior to their death. So when I read this story and how difficult life was, and that's the insanity part, Jan, I pick up my telephone and call my assistant and said to her, I need us to find 4 kids. They live in this Simpoor Bridge community and blah, 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 blah. And she said, Madam Bowie, I don't understand what you're talking about. Monrovia is a big place. I can never find these children. And I said, well, I hate to hear I can't. So let me drop the phone, call Monrovia. I have a friend. I said, I need you to go to Simpoor Bridge and look for these children.
and she said, Jesus is Lord, the Nobel laureate has gone crazy. That community have over 20,000 people. How do I find four children with a very common last name, like the name you're calling to me? I dropped the phone again, called my assistant and said to her, I read the story, there's a Twitter feed under there. Go back to this person's Twitter page and say, the Nobel laureate, I don't use that often, but it was important then, needs to speak with you. In less than 20 minutes, she called me and said she had gotten in touch with the reporter who wrote the story. Is there a local contact? Yes, there was a young man who had taken these children, their kids as their kids, and finally I was on the line in 1 hour with this young man. In another hour, I was speaking to the children, and the next day, we had one SUV filled with food to take to them. The young man who had brought us to these children, and I had said to Jay, you know what, even though I said I was cutting back on work, can I take these four? I promise you solemnly across my heart, it's the last four. And he nodded, not believing a word I said. So we took those four and we decided to support them. The young man calls back and say, I have 14 more. Not children, families in similar situation. 14 more sets of orphans, ranging from 5 kids to 6 kids to 4 kids to 3 kids that have lost their parents. This young man has no reason to care. He is not married. He has a full-time job. But when the virus struck, he decided this is what I can give back to my community. Using his motorbike and going from one house to the other, one community to the other, trying to do a data analysis of children that had lost both parents to the virus. If you said to him, I have a donation, he never takes a dime from you. He takes you to the home of these children, you make your donation, and he gets back out. That has been his everyday work for the past few months. So after we get these four to add to our number, someone comes back to me and say there are 5. I say, oh Lord, how do I break this news to family that I have 5 more that I want to take? But these 5 range from the age of 17, 12, age 7, and 4 months old. They've lost their parents. So of course I took those 5 and now I have 9. But the point that I'm trying to make is that when trouble strikes, whether it's here in the US, whether it's somewhere else, people need to try and care. You know, no Liberian, no West African, even those who did not come from Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, West Africa has 16 countries, can tell you they did not have some kind of issue of stigma, especially in this country, when the Ebola virus struck. A taxi driver said, but as soon as he asked me, where are you from? I said, Liberia. Ooh, do I need my PPE? His personal protective equipment. I said, no, sir, you don't need it. But children in school, people everywhere, it became a political ploy in this country. When it was magnified during the elections time, it wasn't because people cared. It was because we exploit this situation, incite fear, and win. And once we win, to hell. And this is not just with the Ebola virus, and even though this is the case that we're dwelling on, but this is something that we need to, the good people of this world need to begin to educate. And I'm glad that we have a lot of young people in this room, that we no longer have global problems. Every global problem today is a local issue. from April to March, Ebola was a northern Liberia problem. From May to June, it was a national problem. In July, it became a regional problem. From August to September, it was a global problem. So if you think that today I can sneeze in Virginia and it's just going to be a sneeze, you got it all wrong. You sneeze in Virginia and someone in Kenya will catch a cold. That's how small our world has become. So whilst you have people like Moulton in communities working with orphans, you also have a group of young people and women who have stepped out to start to do the education and sensitization around sex. Because one of the fastest means of transmission, even if a person got well from the Ebola virus, is through the semen and breast milk. And so men, especially who have been cured, are supposed to abstain from sex for 90 days to be really clear 110 days. And some of the issue of of infection came when people were coming out of the treatment units and were not abstaining from sex. So again, communities step up to say we have to educate women and men, and all on the local radio station, because that was the problem in December when the survival rates increased, especially for men, the infection rate started increasing for women. And so communities now had to get back onto sensitization. The Ebola has come down. We have 6 active cases, actual 6 cases in Liberia today. Students are about to go back to school. There is still looming fear about whether there will be an outbreak. We still have healthcare infrastructural issues to deal with. Our economy has gone from bad to worse because of this. There were no trading. As a matter of fact, today we have only 2 international flights flying into Liberia and 1 regional flight, SN Brussels and the Moroccan airline, and then the Cote d'Ivoire Air. So that has taken us back another long way. Some countries are just now easing the border restrictions, and governments in West Africa are beginning to pay solidarity visits for confidence building in countries and with people. Communities continue to keep their eye out, and for places like Liberia, where it's an easy thing to welcome visitors, right now people are very, very cautious about visitors migrating from one community to the other. We've been on a journey as a people, not just as Liberians, as West Africans, and as Africans, because it's been a difficult journey. And we've also been on a journey for those in this country who sent out prayers, because it was like a war. And there were many emails, people praying and thinking. So that was a journey. But I think one of the main reasons that I agreed to be here to honor the work that these young people have done is to reinforce the fact that just as these young people did not need professors to tell them how to do it, that's how local people did not need experts from outside to tell them how to work on it. Some experts came, they understood that it was a journey, and the journey with the Liberian people. Some expert came and thought we're here to save them. A lot of the investments they put in there is not worth it, because people built $25 million treatment unit at a time when the virus had dropped. And I think if they were asking and consulting with communities about what do we do with this money, it would have been more helpful, and communities coming back to say this is what we need to do. So it's really been a journey. But again, what learnings do we take from this journey? For me personally, as an activist, I think it's important for us to continue to popularize local initiative so that we don't continue to look as those poor suffering Africans who can never really get it right. That's the first thing. The second thing, I think we should be insist that we are front, center, and around every dialogue about our issue. A few months ago, I went to an event, and it was so sad that there were Liberians and Sierra Leoneans in the room, but the entire panel discussing Ebola was all white people. And they were talking about it as if they lived the situation and they were experts. And some of these people who were on the panel flew into Liberia for 2 days. And every international organization was now calling them and asking them to give their expert opinion on what they saw. You cannot see a thing in 2 days, especially from the airport, political meetings, your hotel room, and black pack on the airplane. So is it the air that you breathe that gave you the knowledge of what you're bringing back out here or something? But these are some of the issues that I think we need to do, continue to do. I again want to say thank you, and I will take some time to have questions or to answer questions. I don't know how long we have to go, G. You're the timekeeper. So I'll take questions from people and let's engage. Thank you. Wow. Good. All right.
So Lima, for those who have not followed a path of activism, for whatever reason, young, maybe a little insulated, how do we start? How would you suggest we start?
Thank you. I think this afternoon, I said it to, it was this evening. Okay, so in my insanity, I forget dates, time. So it's crazy to know where I am, when I am, where I am. But I say to young people, I'm glad again that we have a lot of young people in the room. Today, it's very easy for people to be apathetic about situations around them. And it's very easy for us as adults to look at, I find myself constantly pulling myself back when my kids have some ideas that I am, You know, that's the typical African mom, But society have taught me, let them fly. I have seen that the ideas that are groundbreaking are usually crazy. They don't make sense to anyone. So as young people, and I'm speaking directly to the young people in this room, if you feel like there is something that you want to do, write it down. And in the morning, if you walk up to your mom and say, Mommy, this is my idea. If she said, girl or boy, that's crazy, you're on the right track. And the example I give is Dr. King, Rosa Parks, Gandhi, all of these great men and women who made changes in their time. When they stood up and said they were going to do things, no one believed them. I remember when we started our mass action protest, my boss at the time said, where is your concept note? Who's your donor? What is your SWOT analysis of the situation? What is your security analysis? And as he was talking, first we were all in the room listening to him very keenly, but one after the other we left. And it was just him in the empty chairs talking about SWOT analysis. But it's here. It's that thing that keeps you awake at night. So I tell young people, whether it's animal rights or human rights or women's rights, when it happens, you are angry. But you're not angry to pick up a gun or a knife, but you're angry and sometimes you find yourself writing furiously. Do I have people here who feel that way, or am I the only crazy person in this room? Okay. So if you find yourself doing that, and then once you've told that adult and they've said to you you're crazy, and you find a friend, and that friend said, great idea, that's your first ally. Don't pull back. That for me is what makes, or those are the things that bring about the changes that we're looking for in the world. People that will not hold back their crazy ideas, and people that will step out boldly. I was saying to a group of young people the other day, in this world, when we sit down and have a mental war about giving a seat to an old lady, evil people are boldly walking into places and blowing us up. So it's time for us to stop rationalizing doing good and just do it because it feels good. It's time for us to stop rationalizing why should we care? And if you have that impulse that is not going away, just step out there and do it. A reverend once said, I go to Riverside Church when I'm in New York, and his sermon theme was, where has crazy gone? Because all of the abnormal things in our world today are normal. You know? I was in Miami the other day and saying to a corporate group, every day you read the news and have a news buzz. This NBA player crossed and took an old lady across the street. That was such a nice thing. This person bought a person a car. So it's abnormal to do good. It's abnormal to advocate for social justice, but it's normal to walk into a school and kill 20 kids and blast up different things. So if we have to bring this world back to normal, we need to start boldly stepping out and not being afraid of putting our crazy ideas out there. That's my take.
I wanted to ask you, because you've talked about the strength of communities and their proactive response in Liberia, I'd like to know how you would compare the experience of Sierra Leone and the exchange of tactics and approaches and cultural approaches between the two countries.
Liberia, fortunately, has a very strong civil society. Whether we like it or not, we have that at our advantage. We can mobilize at the drop of a hat. Even if it doesn't make sense, we will try to work with it until it makes a lot of sense. Sierra Leone, on the other hand, really doesn't have the kind of strength in civil society as Liberia. So the tackling of this whole virus has nothing to do with, it has a lot to do with resources, but primarily it has to do with community and engagement. And if you do not have that, you can have $10 billion and it can be affecting 20 persons in one community. Without the strategies and the tactics to engage your community, you will never get there. And from July till today, communities in Liberia failed, but they were not shy about failing every time because I remember when my foundation started giving out funds to local communities, we were just giving. People would come and give us their ideas and we gave them. And it wasn't big money. We were able to grant in a three local organization with 500, 1,300, 400, but these people were able to take that small amount and turn it into huge resources because they were in the communities and engaging. So you had little boys who had soccer team, young girls, all of these different groups were doing what they had to do. So it was all about engagement. Radio stations using local vernacular or local jargons to get to people about it, local artists making songs. And whilst the Sierra Leoneans try, the other thing is, culturally, it is really entrenched in their society. The good and bad about, the good, bad, and ugly about Liberia is the American influence. So yes, we have the thing with tradition, but it's not as entrenched as it is in Sierra Leone. So we have some of those things at, you know, to our advantage. Is there an exchange of strategy and tactics now? Yes. I just told you about the representative who sent his team into Sierra Leone to help them, the ambulance and the unit. And the cell phone was a really huge help. So because calling radio stations, tracking patients, people calling and say, these strange people, we haven't seen our neighbors outside for a few days, can the ambulance come to their homes? So it was a really good tool also for tracking the virus and helping to tackle it. You can still come. Come on, sir, come on.
You talked about the attitude of experts coming in. And I think in general, Americans usually think they're the experts in everything. I mean, we think we have the best health system of the world, even though we're probably down number 10 or 30. So what advice do you have for Americans going in? Because what Americans do have is resources, but how do we do that?
It's always important to come with the attitude of, I've come on a journey. I've come to listen. How can we help? You know, I like to tell this famous story that we heard in Liberia years ago about a group of non-for-profit who went to a village. And after a few days of being in the village, decided that a hand pump was what the villagers need. Pump water, because the women were suffering by going to the creek and the stream to get water. 6 months into the building of the hand pump in the middle of the town, another group goes in to do an assessment of the community and realize that most of the women were alcoholics. So that group decided, let's sit down and have a conversation. These women live in a domestic violent, in a community where domestic violence, most of them experience it. They had issues with children, they had issues with the economics, they had issues with different things. And walking to the stream was their trauma healing. They would talk 1 hour and talk 1 hour. And by the time they got back, they were okay. A hand pump in the middle of the town meant there was nowhere to exhale. So alcohol became their refuge. This story is just a reminder that regardless of how much you think you know and how much analysis you think you can do on the internet, there's nothing like the people's touch. There's nothing like going in and sitting and just doing like this and telling them, I am behind you. And you take this journey and I will journey with you. Because it's not everything. If I walk into this room and see a couple holding hand and being all lovey-dovey, it could just be they're doing it for TV. Because, and then I decide just from looking through this room and say, I honor you as the best couple in Harrisonburg. That's the attitude. Because you don't live there, you don't know the context, you don't know the people, and you can definitely not say, I have all of the contextual knowledge. A few years back, I took a young lady from Switzerland, after she came to Liberia, then to Sierra Leone, and went back and did a report. I said, trust me, if I see you in a year, your CV will read expert in security sector reform in West Africa. Lo and behold, yes, she's written several books, expert security sector reform. How do you do that? How can your conscience allow you to sleep knowing that you're no expert, you just visited? So I think to answer your question is coming in and listening. Coming in and trying to figure out, journeying with a group of people, especially to you young people leaving college with this whole attitude of, I want to save the world. Baby, you can't save me in Africa. It's my turf. All you can do is help bring the resources and journey with me. Even me as an African, as a Liberian, I cannot go back into Liberia today and say, these are the answers to the question for post-Ebola recovery. It has to be consultation with communities to say, where do you think we can start? How do you think we can start? When do you think we can start? And is there any way that I can help besides resources? That should be the attitude of anyone going into anyone's space to work.
Madam Bowie, it's really nice to hear you tonight in person. One question I have is, has there been any outreach to you and others of your colleagues as the international community reassesses all the way that it did not handle what happened with Ebola? I heard today that WHO is going, oh my, we messed up, we did not do a good job on this. But I'm just wondering if there's been any indication that they're more open to listening to those of you who are living the life there. Thanks.
I think sometimes the people who come to help, their ego container is bigger than the service that they bring to the people. Some people will reach out. Others will decide who they reach out to. And if reaching out means conferring with the politicians on the ground, obviously it takes someone like me out of the equation, because then we are troublesome, we're troublemaker, and we're going to say things that I was at CGI in September last year, and they were talking about, and someone asked this question about the Ebola, how did it fly from us? And I turned and looked at Hillary and looked at Chelsea and said, I know our government is a friend of you all, but I have to say this. Corruption and incompetence brought us to where we find ourselves. They weren't very happy, but I had my say. There was a gap in the room and then applause. You know, but again, people will not reach out if you're too truthful. People will only reach out because everyone wants to feel good about what they think they're doing. And sadly, the international community and a lot of the international group finds themselves at that place where it's more about me being applauded than it's more about. So every opportunity I get, I was at Security Council and I dropped my bomb and left everyone gapping like this, you know? So every opportunity I get, I will have my say, because they may never invite me again. Or they may never invite me on some high level panel or anything like that. But to be honest with you, beyond the Ebola, there are some panels and task force that the UN has established that I find myself sitting on. And sometimes I say, you sit on these things to give a voice. But if I had to do it again, I probably will not, because I think it takes a lot away from you. People already know what they want to do, how they want to do it, and they're just looking for a means of saying, some of you were a part of this process. So that's where we find ourselves. But I mean, in conclusion, I think we're ending, right? In conclusion, I would say that Like I said earlier on, the Ebola virus came, it took a lot from people. But let's start thinking beyond Ebola. Ebola killed close to 10,000 people in three countries in West Africa because of the slow response of the international community, the corruption of these individual governments that no one wanted to listen to, and the incompetence in some of the local international structures in handling this problem. As we reflect on Ebola, let's reflect on some of the crises that we see globally. You want to start asking yourself, how did we get from getting rid of Saddam Hussein to ISIS today? How did we get from the Arab Spring to a Libya and Egypt that is in total disarray? How did we get from a government that was seemingly responsive to the needs of his people to a place where it's all about politics? How did we get to a place where, even in this day and age, when this government is sending millions of dollars in the interest of women and girls, there are still laws and policies in this country that is not affecting women? How did we get to the place where trying to do good is taking us backwards more than forward? So as we think about Ebola, as we think about supporting these young people, let's think about all of these things and then ask ourselves again, why should we care? And the answer I will give you, one, because there are more good people in this world than evil. Two, to bring back faith in humanity. Eleanor Roosevelt once said, do one thing every day that scares you. I say to you, do one thing every day that everyone is afraid to do. Thank you.
We give her another round of applause. That was an amazing speech.
Next up, we have an opportunity, I'll say, for all the people who didn't have a chance to give, and even for all the people who had a chance, but feel it, it's that heart's calling to do more. There will be offering baskets going around. And the foundation that will receive this donation has made a short thank you video that we'll be showing soon.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Gwendolyn Myers, and I'm the executive director of Messengers of Peace Liberia, a nonprofit voluntary-based organization into volunteerism for peace and development. And at the moment, we manage 1,000-plus young people as volunteer peace messengers to our various peace clubs, initiatives in schools and communities, and also our mentoring and coaching programs for adolescent girls in peace building, our educational leadership programming, and our community-based action to our advocacy initiative. I'm sorry for obvious reason I cannot be with you today, but I'd like to take this opportunity on behalf of the Liberian people, on behalf of the Board of Directors of Messengers of Peace Liberia, our 1,000 plus volunteer peace messengers constantly in the field of Ebola sensitization, and of course on behalf of myself as Executive Director of Messengers of Peace Liberia, to say a very big thank you for your support. Your presence here this evening at this fundraising dinner reaffirmed our belief in the goodness of humanity. We thank the entire Eastern Mennonite University family, the Center for Justice and Peace Building, and a very big thank you to the International Student Organization, ISO, for organizing this event, for your solidarity and your kindness. Do have a lovely evening. Good evening, everyone. My name is Gwendolyn Myers, and I'm the Executive Director of Messengers of Peace Liberia, a nonprofit voluntary-based organization into volunteerism for peace and development. And at the moment, we manage 1,000 plus young people as
sometimes in our lives, we all have fear, we all have sorrow, but if we are wise, we that there's always tomorrow. Lean on me when you're not strong, and I'll be your friend. I'll help you carry on, for it won't be long till I'm going to need somebody to lean on. Please swallow your pride if I have faith for you to borrow, for no one can fill those of your needs that you won't let show. You just call me, brother, when you need a hand. We all need somebody to lean on. I just might have a problem that you'll understand. We all need somebody to lean on. Lean on me when you're not strong, I'll be your friend. I'll help you carry on, for it won't be long till I'm going to need somebody to lean on. Well, you just call on me, brother, when you need a hand. We all need somebody to lean on. I just might have a problem that you'll understand. We all need somebody to lean on. If there is a load that you cannot bear, that you can't carry, a friend right there till the end. Call me, 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 call me.
Good evening. My name is Susanna Lepley. I'm the advisor for the International Student Organization. I want to thank Ms. Bowie, first of all. You may not know this, but she donated all of her time and all of her expenses to come here this evening and share with us. So, I also want to call all of the students up here from the International Student Organization, so come on up here, and I'll read their names. G. Pagar, Winifred Gray Johnson, Kaltuma Nuro, Victoria Gunawan, Zoe Parakul, Marcus Ekman, Yael Gamtesa, Nora Alobikan, Brenda Soka, Sanju Lee, and Danica Salcedo, and Nandi Onetu. They worked tirelessly in the last several weeks to put this event together. They gave of their time, of their energy, and of their incredible gifts to bring you this wonderful program. So thank you. And Jan Jenner, come on up here too. Or at least stand up. Jan was, of course, the one who got us access to Ms. Bowie and also helped us organize everything as well. So thank you, Jan. And thank you for a wonderful evening. The students have one more event. If you're an EMU student, you can go to Common Grounds and have dessert and selfies with Lima. So thank you all again. Have a good evening.